Hello and welcome to Breakpoints, the Society of Infectious Diseases Pharmacists podcast. My name is Megan Klatt, and I'm an infectious diseases and antimicrobial stewardship clinical pharmacist at the University of Kansas Health System in Kansas City, Kansas. For today's episode, we will be exploring the intersection between infectious diseases and public policy. In the post-COVID era, we're all aware of the ever-growing concerns with antimicrobial resistance and the need for a robust antimicrobial pipeline. Since 2014, we've had a tremendous amount of new antimicrobials in development and come to market. Yet they still aren't supported, and we've seen the rapid rise and fall of some promising agents, as well as a lot of drug companies leaving the antimicrobial development space. So what are the barriers for drug companies in developing new antimicrobials? What are the various legislation, incentives, and policies in this space? And what can we do as infectious diseases and non-infectious diseases clinicians to support positive change? If you're new to this topic, Breakpoints episode 19, entitled Push and Pull, Combating Antibiotic Resistance from Discovery to Market Reform, is a resource for additional information. I am so incredibly fortunate to have three experts on this topic with me here today. Our first guest is Dr. Rami El-Shabori. Dr. El-Shabori is the Director of Clinical Pharmacy Services at Massachusetts General Hospital. He provides leadership support for inpatient and ambulatory clinical pharmacy services, along with the pharmacy residency programs, focusing on efficient, timely, and optimal pharmaceutical care. He also serves as the residency program director of the PGY2 Infectious Diseases Pharmacy Residency. Dr. El-Shabori earned his Doctor of Pharmacy degree from the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy. He completed PGY1 Pharmacy and PGY2 Infectious Diseases Residency training at Abbott Northwestern Hospital in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He is a board-certified pharmacotherapy specialist and board-certified infectious diseases pharmacist. Rami, great to have you on Breakpoints.
Thanks for having me.
Joining Dr. El-Shabori is a Breakpoints veteran, Dr. Michael Dudley. Dr. Dudley is the current president, CEO, and co-founder of QPEX Biopharma in San Diego, California. And of note, QPEX Biopharma now operates as a Shionogi Group company in anti-infective drug discovery and development following its acquisition by Shionogi Inc. in 2023. He has over 30 years of experience in anti-infective R&D and commercialization, including leading a team associated with four regulatory approvals for antibiotics in the previous decade. He was responsible for a $41 million Series A venture capital financing of QPEX Biopharma, advanced three programs to IND status with the FDA in 3 years, and has led negotiations for multiple public-private partnerships for over $190 million to advance the development of antimicrobial agents here in the U.S. and in Europe. Mike, welcome to Breakpoint.
Thanks, Megan. Great to be with you.
And last but certainly not least is Dr. Helen Boucher. Dr. Boucher is the Dean and Professor of Medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine and Chief Academic Officer of the Tufts Medicine Health System. An active infectious diseases physician, she was previously chief of the Division of Geographic Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center and the director of the Stuart B. Levy Center of Integrated Management of Antimicrobial Resistance. Dr. Boucher's clinical interests include infections in immunocompromised patients and Staphylococcus aureus infections. Her research interests focus on Staphylococcus aureus and the development of new anti-infective agents. She is the chair of the National Institutes of Health Antibacterial Resistance Leadership Group Innovations Working Group and serves on the executive and steering committees. Dr. Boucher is published in such journals as the New England Journal of Medicine, Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy, and Clinical Infectious Diseases. She is associate editor of Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy and editor of the Sanford Guide to Antimicrobial Therapy and Infectious Diseases Clinics of North America. In 2015, Dr. Boucher was appointed a voting member of the Presidential Advisory Council on Combating Antibiotic-Resistant Bacteria and elected treasurer of the Infectious Diseases Society of America. She was awarded the IDSA Society Citation Award in October 2015 and the Maxwell Finland Award in 2022. In 2023, she became an honorary fellow, Royal College of Physicians of Ireland, the highest award the Royal College of Physicians of Ireland can confer. Dr. Boucher serves as the chair of the Board of Trustees of the College of the Holy Cross and as chair of the Board of Trustees of the Physicians of Tufts Medical Center. Thank you, Dr. Boucher, for joining us on Breakpoints.
Megan, thank you so much for having me and for that very kind introduction. It's really great to be with you.
So great to have you here again. Really a truly amazing group to have on today's Breakpoints. Helen, can you get us started with providing us a bit of background on the history of the antibiotic pipeline and why it can be so challenging to bring a new antibiotic to market?
Sure, Megan. I'm happy to kick it off, and I'm sure that Mike and Rami are going to want to chime in. So, you know, the history of antibiotics is really interesting, and there's a lot of good, right? Antibiotics are life-saving medicines that came to pass in a post-war era and changed the history of medicine from that time. And, you know, in my younger days, we saw sort of the heyday of antibiotics. And by the late 1980s, there was a real peak with new antibiotics being churned out on an annual basis. The big pharmaceutical companies, Pfizer, Merck, et cetera, had big discovery and development teams discovering and developing new antibiotics. And it was really exciting. But after that, we saw a decline that was alarming. And by 2021, there were only 25 antibiotics in development. And all of us were involved in sort of calls to action for this problem, although Rami was younger, I would say, at that time. But, you know, we started with the Bad Bugs, No Drugs campaign with IDSA, and then a lot of work over the next several decades, including the 10 by 20 campaign, to try to incentivize, get people interested in coming back into this business. We saw first an exit of large pharmaceutical companies, which was really concerning because of their history of success in this area and because they had a brain trust of experts, of scientists doing the discovery and the development. So taking what are now antibiotics from the stage of not even having a number, you know, from the most basic of basic science all the way through to being medicines for people, those all went away. And the sort of intellectual and human capital drain that caused was huge. And the work went into smaller companies. And Mike can certainly comment as he's been very successful in that space. But that and many other things, but most importantly, the market problems led to a lot of the problems that we're still dealing with today. And as you alluded to in the open, we did see some success. We worked on things like endpoints, on regulatory pathway, making it more feasible to get antibiotics for the most important infections over the finish line. We saw success. In fact, we saw more than the needed 10. We saw 14 drugs by 2019. And some of these addressed the biggest problems of that time, which were the resistant, mostly gram-negative organisms that we face in our patients in the hospital. So that was good news. But the bad news was, as I often say, nobody was buying these drugs. And companies went either out of business, bankrupt, like as in the case of Acagen, or close to that, sort of dwindled away. And very importantly, a number of those medicines became no longer available to our patients, right? We couldn't access them. And in fact, many of them were developed using taxpayer dollars, right? These push incentives that you talked about on your prior podcast. So really, really important. If we turn to sort of the challenges that we face today, and I know others will want to chime in, right? Antibiotics are hard to develop. Discovering antibiotics is hard work. And so for years, we talked about the science and the difficulty of the science. I think the fact is that where we sit in 2024, and I'd love to hear what my colleagues think about this, there's a lot of exciting science, right? If you look at what's in the early development pipeline, there's a lot of good stuff coming our way. But still, the job of making something that is that kills the bacteria, not the human, hard work. And I'll come back to the economic piece of this, right? All the work that goes into developing antibiotics, and we do have great science and great things to explore, if they're delivered into a dysfunctional or non-functional market and those developers can't recoup a return on their investment. And I would point out those developers, be they a company, a government, a nonprofit, whoever invests in them, if they can't recoup that investment, they can't put that back into developing and discovering new antibiotics. So that's a big problem. And part of the economic problem is that antibiotics are low priced. They always have been, and kind of the expectation is that they always will be. They're used for a short period of time. We're learning that shorter is better, and that's probably been the topic of another podcast. And we, people like me in infectious diseases, tell our trainees, our students, and our colleagues not to use them unless we absolutely need to, because we know that every time we use an antibiotic, that increases the rate of resistance, not just to that medicine, but to potentially other medicines. And that affects not just potential patients I treat, but the whole community and the whole population. So those things together, along with the fact that oftentimes when we make a new antibiotic and bring it to the market, people like me are slow to start using it. And for years, we had a delay in getting things like guidelines to help us know that this new antibiotic should be used. And we've made a little progress in that department, but that's another thing that's frequently cited as a barrier. So maybe I'll see, Mike or Rami, what you want to add to those issues with antibiotic development.
Thank you, Helen. I certainly agree with everything you just said. Antibiotics are unique. No other classes in medicine have this unique aspect of loss of function over time with increased use. Not a lot of other classes have the same unique aspects of having the community public health impact of losing one medication for a patient affecting other patients and other medications or other classes or even other agents within the same class. So overall, antibiotics are unique and they do require unique solutions. I think the economy of the market right now just does not support that cycle. On the front line, clinically, antimicrobial stewardship and protecting and preserving these newer agents is definitely the right thing to do. But on the other side, by doing the right thing, we are adding challenges to the market and really taking a lot of the competitiveness of the market away. Therefore, other companies, large and small, are not incentivized to participate in the development process. So really, we find ourselves in this universe of trying to do the right thing, but by doing the right thing, the consequences are not very good.
Yeah, I think both of you have really hit on some important points and don't have too much to add to that. Although, let me try to unpack, and I know as we get deeper in the podcast, we'll come back to this. But I think just a couple of things that would be helpful. I think when you look at the problem with the antibiotic market or problems with it is that we haven't had enough revenue flowing into the system to really support an innovation cycle. And this has actually been coming to bear with discussions that are taking place in the public square in the context of the Inflation Reduction Act or the forced negotiation that's taking place now with Medicare with companies about successful drugs and about how the importance of when you have a success in the marketplace, that serves as the revenue that can serve as feedstock for your next generation of agents. And whether we're talking about antibiotics or we're talking about anti-cancer agents or we're talking about drugs for diabetes, this is the same story, is that you have to have enough revenue coming into the system to be able to do that. And I think the system that was set up sometime in the 80s that really limited the ability for antibiotic therapy to have a price-finding mechanism and a value-based system for reimbursement, I think is what's been responsible for, as Helen nicely described, of kind of the fleeing of the fields. But if you look and see that if there is sufficient value-based reimbursement of drugs, not just on an individual basis, but from a societal value, you will be able to then to stimulate investment. So I say that the problem of the broken marketplace is fundamentally a value and an insurance problem that needs to be fixed. And unless that is fixed, we're not going to be able to have enough dollars flowing into the system to support innovation. And we'll talk about that a little bit more about what are some of the examples when you have enough this to really support a vital pipeline of new drugs.
Thank you so much for that great overview of the general issues surrounding the use of these agents. But Mike, you have a really unique perspective from your experience in industry. So can you tell us why it can be so challenging for drug companies to bring an antimicrobial to market?
Yes, I think it's oftentimes brought forth that perhaps it's very expensive to develop a new antibiotic, but in reality, it actually isn't compared to some other therapeutic areas. So it really isn't that much more expensive. I would say that FDA has done a lot to help with this. It's certainly by some of the pathways that we can talk about in a minute here that have been created, that really has helped drive down the cost of developing new antibiotics. But I think fundamentally what's going to need to happen is that we're going to have an environment here that gets global pharmaceutical companies back into the game. What Helen has described over the more recent years has been sort of a story of small companies driving innovation. And that's actually true. And if you look over the last 13 years, there were 17 antibiotics and antifungals that earned FDA approval in total in the U.S. 15 of those approved agents progressed from what I will call the translational stage of where they went from preclinical to filing an IND and to actually going into the clinical realms. 15 of those 17 from transition from preclinical to clinical came from small pre-commercial companies. And usually these companies were funded by venture capital, with or without the assistance of some of what we'll call push incentives, which are those incentives that are helping to support research and development. So there were only two that were brought forth into through that phase by large pharmaceutical companies, Shionogi for one with sifidercol and Merck with imipenem-relebactam. So the rest of them involved in with those smaller companies actually taking drugs forward. I mentioned FDA and some of the things that they have done. So FDA and regulators such as the European Medicines Agency and the EU have done much to help us with developing clear guidance and even accelerated development pathways. And one pathway that IDSA and many others really championed a few years ago was developing what was called an LPAD or a limited population anti-infective drug pathway, which was designed to help companies progress agents through development and ultimately to earn FDA approval for drugs that would be treating a serious or a life-threatening infection. And these so-called streamlined development programs would, for example, require fewer clinical trials, which both costs time as well as money to go through. And the drugs that go through an LPAD pathway then would be approved based upon a benefit-risk assessment. So hence, it's for an unmet need and for patients who have limited choices. And there would be labeling, meaning that there are statements in the indication statement of the prescribing information that communicates that these drugs are approved under these pathways and that they're really designed for a limited population of patients. Now, there actually haven't been very many drugs approved by specifically the LPAD pathway, but I will tell you that there's lots of antibiotics that have been approved over the last 5 to 10 years that have actually been approved under this kind of doctrine or under this philosophy that the FDA brought to bear within that. And meropenem, beberbactam for one, ceftazidime, avibactam for another, and sifidercol, same idea that they were allowing then these drugs to be used for patients with limited choices. So that's been an important part that I think has helped with getting drugs approved, as Helen mentioned, but not necessarily stimulating an ecosystem that would allow for continued innovation. So what I'll leave you with is that once you get approval, we now move into a revenue problem. We have a problem that the payment systems for inpatient care, where those drugs that we just talked about for those patients with limited choices, is antiquated and doesn't value these modern drugs and other technologies as they should. What has happened unfairly is that hospitals have been expected to kind of shoulder the burden of making these drugs available to patients and essentially trying to secure the return on the investment for the innovator for doing that. And that's what has to get fixed if there's going to be a long-term solution for ability to innovate within this space.
Thank you so much. You mentioned the fact that there are these push incentives. For those of us who are new to this field, Rami, can you describe some of these incentives to stimulate growth? What are push and pull incentives?
Yeah, of course, push incentives are trying to accelerate reaching the market, and pull incentives are trying to sustain the market once it does reach that market entry set point. A lot of push incentives have been successful in the last number of years. Mike mentioned a few, Helen alluded to that as well. We've seen funding help very early in the stage of clinical development. We've seen regulatory pathways that have been shortened and decreased the cost and the burden of development. And we've seen collaborations between private and public institutions, public dollars, tax-funded dollars being offered to smaller companies that may not have access to a lot of funding to help get the product development started and sustained all the way to regulatory approval and market entry. On the other side, we haven't really seen a lot of advances or momentum on the pull side. A number of good, successful treatments made it to the market. However, those incentives to sustain the market and provide the revenue back to what turned out to be a large number of smaller companies that are very much heavily reliant on these revenue streams to stay in the market, and let alone start developing the next generation of agents. So on the pull side, we really haven't seen a lot of interventions on the front line that are helpful, meaningful. Certainly, there have been a lot of proposals, and we'll talk more about those as we continue our conversation. There have been a lot of proposals and a lot of good proposals. And as any proposal for something this complex and that affects insurance side, public dollars, healthcare institutions, hospitals, clinicians, industry, it is complex. There's probably no one perfect solution that will fix the entire market overnight. So really the challenge is looking at a number of different options and a menu of incentives that can both apply to larger companies versus smaller companies, applies to large healthcare institutions and smaller access hospitals that may not have the same funding streams as large institutions. It's trying to give the right balance of different incentives, whether those are market entry awards to the company for bringing a successful product, and what defines a successful product, and who defines a successful product. And this is when we talk a lot about the public-private collaborations that our professional organizations, ID specialties, our ID pharmacy organizations, IDSA, we're ready to help and we're ready to have these conversations and start the dialogue on what we need on the front line and what defines a successful product and what the needs of the patients really are. There have been examples of Me Too agents, and those are good to have, but they're not must have. So again, trying to really place those incentives where they matter the most and where they can be the most meaningful in producing a medication that is truly affecting a small number of patients that have no other options, or the options they have available are not good options. And there are a lot of examples going back. Cefiderocol is a great example of that. An effective agent, a meaningful agent that serves a purpose across a number of different resistant infections. Most recently, sulbactam, durlobactam. Very niche drug. Probably not going to be used for a large number of patients, but when you need it, it will save a life. And it should be valued as such. Valued as a medication that can save a life and prevent that infection from reaching the next patient, breaking that cascade of bad consequences. So we're getting to this point when we have really meaningful interventions for our patients, and we're trying our best on the front line to preserve them and protect them. But the consequence to that is we need a sustainable market incentive on the pull side to help the revenue to smaller companies, but also large companies, encourage them to come back into this environment and this space. So we'll continue to advocate for different solutions. Again, no one solution is going to fix the market. It's going to have to be a menu of options that can be applied differently at different circumstances based on the product, the patient population, the number of patients expected, the value of the medication in terms of what it can offer to different patients.
Absolutely. And I'm going to take a second to humble brag for both you and Mike, since you both are authors of the SIDP position statement on incentives to support antimicrobial drug development. So you're speaking about opening up the dialogue. Tell us a little bit more about this position statement, the background context, and what we can anticipate from this document.
Thank you, Megan. I think this was a product of 3 to 5 to maybe even more years of discussion of how can SIDP add our voices to the dialogue and really help push the dialogue. One thing we quickly discussed and agreed to that we're not writing the position statement to pick and choose which incentive we want to back or we want to put our voices behind, but rather give a good survey of some of the proposals that have been implemented, but also some of the proposals that have been proposed and not implemented yet. We go through them, all of the different options, and we give our voice to what we think would be best. We recognize we're not going to get all of these options implemented. We recognize that over time, new proposals may come along and some of the old proposals may be sunset. We recognize the dynamic nature of the conversation, but hopefully our voice is adding to that dialogue and helping our membership and the public really get a taste of some of the challenges we're having on the front line. We go through the drug development process and we add our voices where we think some meaningful dialogue can begin. We recognize the successes on the push side, on the push incentive side. We call it out and we recognize that public and private partnerships and collaborations have been very successful in bringing a number of agents to the market. And that's great. And we should sustain it. Some of these tax-funded dollars have to be renewed every number of years. So we certainly put our voice to sustain that model and not rely on refunding every few years and have a better long-term solution on that front. We recognize some of the successes on the regulatory front, LPAT pathway, QIDP designations. We recognize the success and we want to celebrate it, but we also would love to see that expanded. We would love to see more agents go through the LPAD pathway. As Mike mentioned, very small number of products actually followed that pathway, at least formally and in an official way. We talk about new technology add-on payment, NTAP, and how that has been a great tool to have if healthcare systems are able to implement it. It takes the DRG carve-out that we all talk about and tries to value antibiotics outside of that very limited DRG bundled payments. That is a good incentive and that is a good solution. On the other side, NTAP hasn't been implemented widely across a lot of healthcare institutions because of the complexity of the implementation, because of the relatively short term of the incentive, 2 to 3 years per product. A lot of our billing, compliance, coding colleagues, hard to retrain the system every 2 years to take the old agents off, add new agents, and be that dynamic. So that really has slowed down a lot of healthcare institutions, especially larger ones, to take full advantage of the NTAP incentive. And we've seen that from CMS data. We had access to some public information. Not a lot of healthcare systems are taking advantage of the NTAP dollars. And of the ones taking advantage of the NTAP dollars, a very small number of them is responsible for the majority of dollars paid out. So certainly it's a good resource that's not fully tapped into. Then we look forward to some of the real world evidence as a contribution to expanding indications, allowing reimbursement for some of these newer agents that may reach the market with only one very specific indication, oftentimes urinary tract infection. A lot of our newer agents that have been very meaningful to us at the front line have the indication of treatment of urinary tract infections. And 9 out of 10 cases, that's not where we're using it. So really expanding access and funding and support for real world experience once an agent is on the market to expand indications, expand the guidelines. And I think that's where our IDSA guidelines have been extremely helpful in really supporting indications for newer treatments beyond what the package insert and what the prescribing information has. And we take it a step farther and we go into the pull incentives. And again, this becomes very complex. Economists don't agree on the right thing to do. Industry probably doesn't all agree on what the one magic bullet can be. And certainly us on the front line, we're trying to advocate for a new system. And this is one of those things, perhaps anything will be better than nothing. So we just got to start and test it and adjust it and make changes where needed. We can't ignore this problem for too long. We talk about some of the proposal in Congress and what we think some of the pros and cons of each of them. Again, we don't support one proposal over another. We just call out where we find helpful and meaningful changes for the future. We talk about DRG carve-outs as probably a solution that has to be part of any future conversation. Value-based pricing of antimicrobials. We talk about market entry rewards as a very useful intervention for the right treatment that affects the right patient population and really use our experts and our professional organizations and ID societies to help define which agents can be very much needed and be candidates for these market entry rewards. Then we end with understanding how complex this problem is and how any solution on the pull side will have to really offer different options for different institutions on the front line, but also different industries, large and small.
Thank you so much. That's clearly a labor of love for you two. And we're so excited to see the final version of that position statement. And again, truly great work by the SADP Policy and Government Affairs Committee. So we've talked a lot about incentives. Rami, you alluded to some policy. Helen, can you give us an overview of the policies that have been proposed here in the U.S. and abroad?
Sure, Megan. I'll talk about a couple things at a high level, and then I'm sure that Mike and Rami are going to want to chime in. And I think we just had a great walk through push and pull and lots of the regulatory considerations. And if you sort of zoom up to another 50,000 feet, right? That's where we get to the policy and advocacy part of this equation. And I'm just going to mention a little bit about advocacy first, even though it's a little off script. So I think all of us have been advocates in this space. And I started, and I remember in 2007, getting the phone call from John Bartlett and Shira Gorbach to get involved with IDSA. And when I started, I thought we were going to make a difference in a year. I thought we were going to do things really fast. And here I am. We won't do the math, but a lot of years later. And so one of the things is this is slow progress. This is a long-term gain. The work we're doing at a high level with policy is trying to formalize and put into law in some cases the changes that will enable a more thriving, innovative market to have a pipeline of antibiotics. And you know, what we need as infectious disease docs on the front line is we need a toolbox. We don't just need one thing. We need a variety of things. And we're talking about antibiotics here, but I'll point out, we need vaccines. We need immunomodulators. We need microbiome altering agents and other things, right? That actually there's some exciting science for, but if you think it's hard to develop a new antibiotic, it's much harder to develop those kinds of therapies. So I just want to put that out there for consideration. If we think about the policies that have kind of seen the most light of day, the first one in the United States I'll mention is the older one called the DISARM Act. And that gets at this value of antibiotic question and comes back to carving out the cost of the antibiotic from the DRG, from the diagnosis-related group bundle payment that most of our hospitals work with. And it really values antibiotics, especially new antibiotics that treat resistant infections, in a way that's more commensurate with the benefits they bring. And it's important to mention, again, antibiotics cure infections. We cure people of their infection and they walk out of here, or they go on to get an operation or get a transplant. That's different from prolonging someone's life with a chronic illness. We forget that when we're talking about antibiotics, but I think it's always important to bring it back. We are in the curing business. So that's DISARM and very valid. And it gets to Mike Dudley's comments about the value of antibiotics. The other policy that is alive and well, bipartisan, bicameral support, is called the PASTEUR Act. And that's a subscription model for incentivizing antibiotics in a pull way, right? So it says that if a sponsor, a company, an entity develops an antibiotic that addresses an unmet medical need that meets certain criteria, and Rami highlighted this, who's going to decide those criteria? A panel set up by the government. So there's a lot of what ifs and things that have to be figured out. But if someone does that, meets those criteria, then they're guaranteed in a contract, a subscription. So they'll get paid X over 5 years for that antibiotic, no matter how much they use. So it's linked to good stewardship. And in fact, it's linked to reporting on antibiotic use. And there's no incentive to overuse that antibiotic. So it will be preserved for as long as possible. This is a win-win for everybody. If you talk to economists like Kevin Outerson and others, they tell you it's a cheap win, relatively speaking, when you think of the cost of resistant infections. But it's money for people who develop drugs. And that has been part of the political pushback. It's still alive and moving. And we, as IDP, IDSA, and others are supporting it in Washington. And I think we've all spent our time advocating for it. Our colleagues across the Atlantic are a little further in their journey. And that's one thing I think for the listeners that still kind of bugs me as a competitive person. In 2024, the U.S. is lagging behind in antibiotic resistance in a number of ways, and this is one of them. The U.K., like the United States, has a national action plan for a coordinated approach of how to combat antibiotic resistance. They are further along in the subscription model. So they did their first subscription model a couple of years ago, and they focused on ceftazidime, avibactam, and sulfitriol. They did the work, they're done, and they've launched the subscription. They're in their second phase, doing the next one. And they have a national health service, and there's a lot of reasons why maybe it's easier for them to be further along. But the fact is, they are further along than we are. And I think that's important. I also would submit that the concept has been proven, right, that a subscription model could work, which I think is interesting and something just to remember as we think about and we're talking to people who say, well, I'm not sure this is going to work. Well, it has worked in the UK. There are some issues when we think about the how of all this work in the US and the rest of the world, or in developed countries versus developing countries, right? So I talked about the US and England, fully developed countries where antibiotics are prescribed by physicians, where everyone has relative access to healthcare. You go to low and middle income countries, it's a very different story, right? The problem in those countries is access to antibiotics. So it's just important, again, to highlight the solutions are different and the how of how we get there is different in different parts of the world. So maybe I will pause and see if Mike or Rami want to add anything about policy.
Yeah, thanks, Helen. That's a great review of the landscape of things. And I think you pointed out on a couple of really important issues that I'll kind of add to as well. You mentioned about other countries being ahead and so forth. I think the real fundamental difference is the difference in terms of how healthcare is financed in those single payer systems versus the system that we have in the United States. Now, obviously, Medicare is the big gorilla in the room, and that's a big payer, and that's certainly a place to start with a lot of these things, as Disarm was trying to do, and as even Pasteur is trying to do as well. That may be the problem. And I think if there was one thing that I would be sort of critical or at least encouraging on the policy side is, as you both have pointed out, is that we've got to be balanced in our approach. And we have to view that what are things that are going to be kind of a temporary fix, and then what the long term is. So the discussions that we'll get into is we kind of have to play by the rules in the United States of other therapeutic areas do. We don't want to create this sort of overweighted system that somehow is so dependent upon it that it can't stimulate those types of investments to go forward. The subscription model, it's interesting. Pasteur is probably more like an Amazon Prime type of membership where you pay for the privilege of still buying the antibiotic. And so you're paying the base cost for all those guys driving around with great vans with smiles on them. So I think that because a lot of pharmacists that I talk to, they say, yeah, I like Pasteur. We're going to get free drug, right? No, you're not going to get free drug. The federal government is going to pay for those contracts for companies to help produce those and make those available. But companies are still going to have to make those available. And Helen, you're absolutely correct about how do we deal with this problem in other geographic areas? How do we deal with a low middle income country problem as well? And I think sometimes if we try to solve this economic problem with the antibiotics, it's a little bit, I liken it to trying to boil the ocean. All drug innovation comes out of the United States. And it comes out of the United States and it goes to other areas of the world. It goes to Europe, it goes to developed countries, and it goes to other countries. There have been some examples of this. So one of the things that really excited us at QPEX about joining Shionogi is their unique program that they put in place with GARDP and the Clinton Health Access Initiative, or CHAI, to make sufentanil available and manufactured under a contract with third-party manufacturers and be available in some of those low-income countries. And so that's a great example of why getting global pharma into this is really important and making those kinds of programs available. But I think it all leads back to is that we need to have some of these other policies and other these legislative ideas in place. But I think then really need to look at the longer-term fix of this problem, which I think is going to be more congruent with how other therapeutic areas have enjoyed the innovation over the last 10 to 15 years that the antibiotic space has not.
Thank you, Mike. And I'll just add some of the pushbacks on some of these proposed laws that would use tax funded and taxpayer money for some of the incentives. I think some of the criticism is it could lead to increased use of antibiotics, which is valid. And, I'll do something I usually don't do. I will offer myself to do more work. And I think part of any of the proposed laws has to be complemented with frontline antimicrobial stewardship, that we should have accountability at the frontline, myself included. We should hold ourselves accountable that just having access to the medications or having a funding mechanism that is less challenging than current state is not an excuse to misuse or overuse these very meaningful interventions that should be protected and preserved. So part of any of the solutions, no matter what the ultimate solution is going to be, Disarm, Pasteur, or some combination of the two, perhaps, all of them will be underpinned by antimicrobial stewardship by ID physicians and ID pharmacists at the front lines. And non-ID physicians and non-ID pharmacists, as a community, we have to really hold ourselves accountable to be grateful for the solutions that may be on the table, but also have an accountability to prove the sustainability of the model, protect and preserve these antimicrobials over time, and report back, share our data, feedback into the system, whether it's tracking antimicrobial resistance, antimicrobial usage, or data, clinical outcome data on the challenging cases that we may end up using these interventions for. So really, we put a lot of pressure and we're asking policymakers and governments to come up with these solutions and put dollars behind it. But at the same time, we have to be part of that system of accountability that if we have an incentive that moves the market ahead, then on the front line, we must have that accountability to give back to the system, sustain it, prove that it's working, prove that that innovation cycle can be maintained while protecting and preserving the interventions we have today on the front line.
Thank you all. These policies and incentives are clearly a step in the right direction, but very few of us are as skilled as you three. So how can the average pharmacist, like you alluded to, Rami, how can our frontline pharmacists and clinicians do their part and help support progress in this area?
I think first step, awareness and being informed. We hear a lot of misconceptions about this space and the current state of the market as, well, it's hospitals making formulary decisions that hurt the market, or antimicrobial stewardship programs that are very restrictive and not using some of these newer interventions. And part of our commitment as well is we need to educate, we need to provide information, like we did with the SIDP position paper. It is partly meant to obviously put our voice behind some of the solutions we believe in, but the other part is educating our membership and the public of a lot of these very complex and nuanced conversations. So being informed, advocating, as Helen said, it is a long game. Nothing is going to change tomorrow or the next month or the next year. And it may not change fully in one step. It may be incremental changes over years and years that eventually, maybe in 10 or 15 years from now, we will have a very well-defined ecosystem of incentives that sustain the market. But it's not going to happen overnight. And just having that understanding of the incremental slow game and continue to advocate one piece at a time, one bill at a time. It may not be a bill by itself. It may be added to another funding vehicle that can have one solution. Small wins can add over time to really big wins. So being informed, putting the burden and the responsibility on our professional organizations to educate their memberships, give them avenues for advocacy, and know what to advocate for and what solutions are being discussed and where do we put our voices behind.
I agree, Rami. I'll take the opportunity because I think we're sitting in a room and we're talking to people who are SIDP members and believers. But in 2024, the sad truth is we still have an awareness problem. And especially in the United States, too few people understand that antimicrobial resistance is a problem, that it affects you, me, our kids, people around us. And I have become more and more convinced that until we solve that problem, the awareness problem, we're not going to get to the next big step. And so whether it's working with other kind of area therapeutic areas, like we've been working more with cancer docs and cancer, because antibiotics underpin all of modern medicine, right? You can't get chemotherapy if there's no antibiotics to support you through it, or a bone marrow transplant if you don't have antibiotics to support you through it. But cancer patients don't think about that. They just think about, I'm going to get my chemo. They don't think about it until somebody like me walks in and says, gee, you have an infection and I can't control that infection, so you can't get any more chemo, right? It's everybody's problem. So I don't have the solution, but I think that awareness of the big problem of antimicrobial resistance is really important. And we can point fingers all day long, but it's still a problem. And we know, for example, recycling. People didn't start recycling until their kids came home from elementary school and told their parents, you have to recycle. Like, we may be doing this all wrong, is my point. And so thinking about the awareness problem at a macro level, I think is really important, as well as all this really great work in policy and advocacy and all the things we're talking about. So that's my two cents. Mike, what do you think?
Yeah, Helen, that's great. And I'm so glad you brought up the kind of the educational problem. And I'll just have one point on that. And then I'm going to kind of take us maybe in a little different direction on what's important on this value side. So I think we have really confused the public a bit on this big problem. And the conversation sometimes goes like this. Antimicrobial resistance, it's a really, really big problem. Oh, really? Well, then why is the marketplace in such a funk about that? Well, so how many resistant infections are you going to treat with this new drug that you brought out? Oh, about 50 to 70,000 patients a year with CRE in the United States. Well, that doesn't sound like a very big problem now, does it? And so I think the problem is we've tried to play the game of this is a big problem, but then we confuse the public when we say, well, you know, we only are going to treat 50,000 patients with CRE infections or 80,000 patients with resistant S. nidobacter infections. And I don't know whether it will be any more successful, but look, we just had Rare Disease Day at the NIH talked about. And my point when I tell people now is that antimicrobial resistance is more like rare disease in that it's not one big problem, but it's lots of little problems. Okay. There isn't one drug that treats all the 200 plus rare diseases that are at the NIH website that talks about rare diseases and genetic diseases. You know, each of those diseases has a specific solution associated with it. And we figure out ways to finance that. We figure out ways in which we can treat those rare diseases that and orphan diseases that are less than 100,000 patients per year is defined by the NIH. And so I think we have a kind of confused the public with this big problem message, because then when we start talking about individual solutions and individual problems, we're talking more like in a rare disease area. So I think that's one. But I think where I'd like to go with this is talk a little bit more about what is going to be the fundamental problem. And whether you're talking about a pull incentive or a policy or legislative change, or whether we're talking about really what you need in the marketplace to be successful, what's important? And I think I made, there's two points on this. One is that an innovator who develops a new drug, whether you're in infectious disease and antibiotics or whether you're in any area of therapeutics, there has to be a period of time where you get a return on the investment, on the risk that has been taken for that. And that in the United States is a period of exclusivity. It may be an exclusivity that is through Waxman-Hatch. It may be a period of exclusivity that comes through intellectual property and patents or some kind of Orange Book listing, which is a listing for exclusivity that is recognized by the U.S. government. But you have to allow that to happen. And we'll talk about why that's important in a second, but it kind of makes sense. But the converse of this is what's been referred to as the compact that pharmaceutical companies have with society. And that compact is that after that period of time of exclusivity that's brought forth by law or by patents, drugs have to go off patent on time. Those drugs have to go off patent and then enter the competitive marketplace where you have automatic price controls built into things. That's what has to happen. And that can be very successful to stimulating that investment, innovation, and then market cycle that has fueled other areas of medicine. And just let me give you a quick example here. Piperacillin tazobactam. It continues to be the most common used IV antibiotic in U.S. hospitals. I don't know how long it's been in that position. Most of that time where it has sat in that position has been when that drug is off patent. That drug, during its period of exclusivity, did okay. It was subject to DRG pricing, which that anything over $100 a day was considered to be an anathema in the 1990s. But piperacillin tazobactam's most of its usefulness has endured past its period of exclusivity. So the question I have for you is that what if piperacillin tazobactam had been priced based upon some consideration of the future value during its period of exclusivity? Maybe Pfizer might still be in antibiotics. Maybe Letterly would still be around in antibiotics. I don't know. But I think that's an example of how we can start thinking about valuing drugs. And so what do we need to do to kind of get this thing started again? If you look, the Biotechnology Innovation Organization, or BIO, did a study that they released in 2022. And what they did was they looked at investment in U.S. oncology companies, and they compared that with investment with antibiotic companies. And what they found is that during a 10-year period that went from 2010 to 2020, there was $26 billion just on venture capital investments in oncology companies alone. And in fact, over the five-year period from 2015 to 2020, there was a 275% increase in that. If you look at the curves, it goes up very steeply. Do you know what the investment over the 10-year period for antibiotic companies was? $1.6 billion of that, or less than 5% of that for oncology. Now, look what's happened in oncology over the last 10 years. Look at the drugs that we've had and the therapies that we have available for that. look at what that $26 billion of just venture investment, and we talk about IPOs, there's another $12 billion in IPOs during that same period of time for oncology companies. So you can talk about $38 billion of investment that has taken place during that period of time. Even one pharmaceutical company last year purchased a smaller company for $21 billion itself just because of the promise of that one drug in oncology. So in the antibiotic investment world, there's no certainty in terms of being able to get that return on investment that will then stimulate that area. So we've got to fix that problem. And the way that we got to fix that is we've got to go to very, very basic premises. And the good news is that there's new tools that have been available. And I think that, to be honest, I get myself in trouble all the time here, but the antibiotic space has been playing checkers and the rest of the world is playing chess when it comes to how we quantify value to society. And we talk about the societal value that antibiotics are foundations of medicine and things like that, but we haven't shown how that actually works. And the good news is that there are some better tools now that are out there for generating value. We just haven't used them yet. And whether that's industry, whether it's policymakers, whether it's our professional organizations, it's hard. I tell people, it's kind of like when people first were confronted with pharmacokinetics, physicians said, oh my gosh, that's really too hard. Those equations are too hard. Well, I know a lot of physicians now are really good at pharmacokinetics because we all kind of got good at the math. And so these have not been applied to antibiotics. They've barely been applied to other therapeutic areas. And the Senate committee hearings, the HELP committee testimony that took place a few weeks ago that was talking about this in the context of that had federal agencies admitting that they could do a better job of assessing value for other therapeutic areas. And I think that's an important part. So let me give you some specifics here. I can complain about this, but let me give you some specifics. And the tools are what are called generalized cost effectiveness tools, or abbreviated GRACE. And a few years ago, the International Society for Pharmacoeconomics and Outcomes Research, or so-called ISPOR, convened a special task force, and they published the results. Megan, I think we can probably put this in the show notes here in terms of this paper and value in health. And what they did is they went through and really talked about the current status about how we assign values to health technology assessment, or HTAs, that you will hear about. And they said that when they looked at what has been used out there, and you can kind of think of this value question as like petals on a flower. Okay, so you have a flower and you have all these different types of components of value. If you think about that, maybe there's like 14 petals that have been identified on that flower. Regulators and health technology assessors in government and oftentimes in others are probably only picking off maybe four of those petals of the 14 that might be available. So we've left a lot of value on the table. So what do we do use? Well, we always use net costs. Okay, that's a no-brainer. But the inconsistently applying things like what about the productivity at a societal level, not just at an individual level, but from a societal level, of the productivity. They pay taxes and so forth. What about things that are adherence promoting? We just now starting to embrace drugs like dalbavancin and aritavancin for, you know, keeping people out of the hospital, which we recognized it was important during COVID. But what about some of these additional elements that are important? Well, what about the insurance value? And Helen, you alluded to this, particularly for somebody who has a baseline status that's poor, like a cancer patient. The value systems that we have not considered that at all. What about the value of hope or precision that takes place by having a good diagnostic test? We can't get diagnostic tests into hospitals because they're not valued appropriately. And so the value of any of those has not been taken in that case. Severity of the disease, some of the metrics that are used to quantify value here are actually, we're missing it because a baseline state of a patient being different, a cancer patient versus a healthy person, a course of antibiotic therapy may be extremely valuable, that same course in a cancer patient than compared to somebody who's younger. What about equity? What about access to the poor? What about the efficiencies of that? What about the equity as part of that? Not been looked at all. I will add here, this is the value of having a small molecule in terms of innovation. because those can be easily made available to places where you can't have cold chains. I think our phage friends have got a lot to answer for right now for a lot of investment that's taking place with phage, because I can't figure out how you're going to have any kind of supply chain for those things into patients that are going to need them. And what about extending the usefulness of proven drug classes? It took us probably around 15 years to figure out how to dose carbapenems, particularly in children. And so what happens when those drugs basically aren't supported anymore? All that knowledge, all that experience kind of goes out the door. And so Pasteur devalues drugs that have been previously approved in terms of having favored characteristics. And I would argue that we're just now learning to use drugs appropriately after 10 years of being on the market. And why not be able to assess a value of those drugs once they are maintained on the marketplace? And we talked about the value of a drug going generics in the context of piperacillin tazobactam. But maybe think about drugs that are useful today. Ceftazidime avibactam will go off patent pretty soon. That's going to be a pretty good deal for patients with KPC infections in a few years when there are generic forms, we hope, of ceftazidime avibactam available for those. So I think those are some of the things. And just one more example, and then I'll stop here, is that there was published last year a paper looking at hepatitis C and the effectiveness of direct-acting antivirals versus the older PEG interferon regimens. And they used some of these measures of value that I just mentioned here for the first time for that. And what they found is that those measures of value that you would do using, you know, typical measures that the government uses now, that when you included these, the value of these direct-acting hepatitis C drugs increased tenfold over what the baseline value was from those. So we got to do a better job. This is like pharmacokinetics in the 1980s. It's hard. The math can be hard sometimes. But there are academic groups that have done a really nice job of doing this. The Schaefer Center and the Mann School of Pharmacy at the University of Southern California gets a shout out for this, for the work that they've been doing. And these are going to be the things that are going to be really critical if we're going to fix this problem going forward.
Awesome. What a great summary. I personally feel very inspired by all of you and think we can all take away the need to increase awareness. So share this episode with your friends and your colleagues and family members as well, because this is a very important problem and something that we need to start working on right now. So let's move on. For the Breakpoints faithful, it's time for I Feel Nerdy. I Feel Nerdy is meant to be a safe space and closing segment for our panelists to nerd out over their favorite ID topics, quirks, and fun facts. For today's I Feel Nerdy, I would love to know, panelists, if you could make any ID practice into law required with no strings attached, what practice would you choose and why? Helen, why don't you start us off?
Oh gosh, Megan, this is a really hard one because I have a lot of choices, but I'm pretty passionate about the mandatory consultation for Staph aureus bloodstream infection. That is the procedure that ID physicians have. And there is a large burden of evidence that shows that outcomes are better, that patients do better, live longer, if there's early complete evaluation in cases of Staph aureus bloodstream infection. And I still sadly hear cases of things that were missed that lead to dire complications. So I'll start with that, but there's a lot more, and I'm sure that Mike and Rami have better ones.
Yeah, that's a hard one to follow, and it's a great one. Can I have two white top at one? That's so unfair.
Of course. You can make as many laws you'd like.
Okay, sounds good. I'll start writing laws. Vancomycin, after 48 to 72 hours with no cultures and no reason to continue, should be a law to stop, no questions asked.
Against vancomycin. Why exactly are we still using vancomycin?
You know, for those places that are still using vancomycin, we should stop it when we can. And similarly, for most infections, outside of the list of infections we all know that need longer durations, any time you go beyond 7 days, there should be a law to explain why you want to go beyond 7 days and not stop shorter than even 7 or 5, except when we all know we need to go longer.
Oh, I like that one. Mike, what's your law?
Yeah, it is a hard one. And so I thought a lot about this. And I think I'm going to say this as somebody who left academic practice, as I mentioned, over 25 years ago. And the reasons behind that maybe are multifactorial. But as sort of somebody who did stewardship back in the 1980s and early 1990s, I think what I would say is that stewardship needs to be regarded as a quality program in our institutions. And I'm not quite sure we're there yet. And I can tell you from personal experience that many stewardship programs, and mine included, was a cost containment program in sheep's clothing. So I think that we still have a lot of this kind of stuff that we've got to get rid of. And I think that it's oftentimes puts people in difficult positions because they're still doing that. So stewardship needs to be fully put into the quality systems. I think our executive producer said to me one time, and I always say it, is that we should not make patients have to fail old drugs to earn new drugs. And there's still too much of this making patients fail the old drug first before they earn getting the new ones. And look, I left practice 25 years ago to do this. And what I want to do is tell our people that we want to make drugs that require textbooks to be rewritten. And I think we want to make sure that patients get the best drugs and solve that problem.
Well, it's really hard to follow all of that. But if I had to pick, I love a good beta-lactam allergy assessment in patients who have a penicillin or cephalosporin allergy. You can't beat having a conversation and delabeling a patient. It's a good win at the end of the day. Well, thank you again for an amazing episode. And thank you to our loyal audience for listening to Breakpoints, the Society of Infectious Diseases Pharmacist podcast. I've been your host, Megan Klatt, and our featured speakers have been Rami El-Shabori, Michael Dudley, and Helen Boucher. Breakpoints was created by Julianne Justo, Aaron McCreary, and Jason Polk. This episode was produced by Megan Klatt and Jeanette Bouchard. It was edited by Kayla Brooks and peer-reviewed by Lean Gunham and Carly Shivko. Our production team includes Justin Moore and Mary Hutton. The executive producer of Breakpoints is Aaron McCreary, and our theme song was recorded by SADP member Steve Smoke. You can subscribe to Breakpoints on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening and helping SADP achieve our vision of safe and effective antimicrobials for now and the future.